Hi, I'm Louisa Higgins from the National Center for Children in Poverty, as Roy introduced earlier. I have no disclosures, and I have no problem with the medical home because I don't come from a health background. So now that I hear everybody else talk about it, I guess I have some problems with it, but that's how I learned about it. Let me give you briefly. The National Center for Children in Poverty is the nation's leading public policy center dedicated to promoting economic security, health, and well-being of America's low-income children. Part of Columbia's Mailman School of Public Health, our mission is to promote the security, health, and well-being of America's low-income children and families. And I'm pleased to be here representing. I'm actually the coordinator of something called Project Thrive, which is part of NCCP's longstanding commitment to promote improved state early childhood policies and practices. The goal of Project Thrive is to help states strengthen and expand their early childhood systems, paying particular attention to strategies that improve services for those at highest risk and that help reduce disparities in access and quality of care to early childhood health and mental health. Project Thrive supports states in their systems building work across the five domains of the ECCS as defined by the Maternal and Child Health Bureau. These would be integrated high-quality healthcare and medical homes, early care and education, social-emotional development and mental health, family support, and parenting education. And currently, 47 states, Washington, D.C., and five territories have funding through MCHB's ECCS initiative, which began in 2002. So this is the MCHB charge to their grantees around access to health insurance and medical home. As I mentioned, they work in the systems building across five domains. And you'll notice that this definition includes screening or referral for oral health as well as maternal depression, which has actually recently been expanded to parental depression and well-being. You'll also see that although these systems building efforts include all children, this definition certainly has a focus on more vulnerable or high-risk children, those living in poverty, non-English speaking families, and domestic violence, child abuse, et cetera. MCHB has adopted the AAPs, or those presented by the AAP and supported by other organizations, the seven elements of a medical home: accessible, family-centered, comprehensive, continuous, coordinated, compassionate, and culturally competent. A medical home is not a person or a place. It is an approach to providing healthcare services in high quality and cost-effective manners. That's their perspective. And the medical home is effective, especially in pediatrics, because families and healthcare providers work as partners to provide services needed to maximize a child's potential. So I've taken this from a piece written by Roy and his colleagues at the Children's Health Fund, which is really looking at the medical home initially through the lens of children with special health care needs, and how do we adopt that for high-risk children. So the CHSCN rubric is typically used to describe children with neurobiological conditions that affect health and development, yet there are other pediatric populations who require good quality, accessible health care beyond that required by children generally, and who are at risk of reduced access to care, primarily for environmental and psychosocial reasons. And the article goes on to say that there's previous research suggested that vulnerable and medically underserved pediatric populations be considered children with special health care needs. These are some benefits of a medical home, but specifically when we look at high-risk or more vulnerable populations, parent involvement, which in some medical home models actually has parent identifying topics to discuss with provider as opposed to the opposite, health literacy, in this case parents understanding their children's health and development, usual source of care as opposed to emergency room or urgent care usage, preventive health services like immunizations, early detection of chronic conditions such as asthma and allergies, which you see so often in low-income children, and early detection of developmental delays through screening efforts, which is probably one of the biggest things that NCCP helps advocate for. And some of the risk factors used to identify who these high-risk children are would be family income, people living below 200% of the federal poverty line, single-parent households, children who've been exposed to domestic and community violence, maternal depression, and children with inconsistent or no insurance. Other risk factors that we would include would be children involved with the child welfare system, children of incarcerated parents, migrant children, the like. So those high-risk children need access to care, continuity of care, and quality care. And access means both insurance coverage and providers that are willing to see children with public health insurance. Going back to that article I just referenced by Roy and Arturo from the Children's Health Fund, they pulled a bunch of data from articles in pediatrics over the last 5 years. Children without health insurance, and this can be inconsistent with public health insurance, are 3 times more likely to have at least one unmet health care need in a year and are 4 times more likely to use emergency room services. And that's just insurance. When we look at other factors that may interfere with access to care, such as parental instability due to mental health or substance use issues, inconsistent housing, lack of transportation, change in caregiver or guardian, children's ability to get the care they need becomes even more difficult. So I'm going to take a couple of minutes to look at the medical home initiative here in Colorado, which was actually included in Colorado's early childhood framework, which started through the ECCS initiative and now actually sits in the Lieutenant Governor's office. As you can see, this has the domains and has access outcomes, quality outcomes, and systems outcomes under health. Or maybe you can't see, but they're there. So the Colorado Medical Home Initiative began in the Department of Public Health and Environment and started in the section dedicated to children with special health care needs. It grew to be a large group of stakeholders, including public, state agency folks, and private insurers and practitioners, representatives from medical, mental health, and oral health fields. The 4 goals of the Medical Home Initiative were for providers to understand the concepts and components of a medical home approach, so that they could implement into their practices, for families to understand the concepts and components of the medical home approach so that they could advocate for those services, for outcomes to be evaluated and systems monitored to assure quality, and for there to be consistent messaging across the state about what a medical home is. This is the logic model, I guess, for the medical home approach here in Colorado. The Jose Esquibel, who's at the Department of Public Health and Environment, talks about how partnership is paramount. And one of the things that I like about the approach in Colorado is that the primary care practitioner doesn't necessarily have to be the responsible one for the medical home. They have access points, and that care is all coordinated no matter what your entry point is through that model. So the pilot program in 2007, after some legislation, led by Dr. Stephen Poole at the Colorado Children's Healthcare Access Program, encouraged pediatricians to devote, I think it was 28 pediatricians, pediatric practices participated in this year-long pilot, encouraging private pediatricians to devote 10% of practice to using a medical home approach for children on public health insurance. Participants who agreed to provide quality medical home services were reimbursed a fee for preventative care, and they also received technical assistance and support services around things like billing and coding and the like. And what they found was that children were more likely to have a well child visit, less likely to use emergency room or be hospitalized, and that state reimbursed costs were lower per child. I had a lot more nice things to say about what they're doing in Colorado. but the last thing I just want to, what we can learn from the Colorado model, and these are the National Association for State Health Policy laid out these 5 major strategies for states who are looking to do work like they've done in Colorado, forming partnerships, creating strong definitions and establishing provider expectations, aligning reimbursement and purchasing, and offering technical assistance and support to practices, as well as lastly, measuring the results to see if their efforts are succeeding. So thank you.
Okay, I want to thank everybody for putting up with my time restraints here. I hope we have a chance to hear more about the Colorado experience and any other statewide demonstration projects that might be out there. I'm going to ask David Schern to make some comments about the critical role of mental health in healthcare home, medical home, call it what you will.
Thanks, Roy. It's great to be here, and it's great to hear the presentations and to hear that At least two of the mental health and substance use issues were explicitly featured. Mental Health America is I'm the president and CEO of that organization. It's the nation's oldest and largest advocacy group for all issues related to mental health and mental illness. We're 102 years old this February. We were founded by a person who had bipolar illness, unsuccessful in attempting to complete suicide, spent several years in the Connecticut State Hospital, and came out after that experience, wrote a book called A Mind That Found Itself, and he came out with a real fervor to reform the mental health system in the United States as it existed then, but also with a really strong focus on public health overall. So they founded something called the Committee on Mental Hygiene, which to this audience probably sounds less odd than it does to most audiences. It sounds sort of like a clean brain society. But what he was wanting to do was he was wanting to model preventative efforts in mental health after the very successful public health models in the public hygiene movement. Much has happened since then. And much has happened over the last two or three years with regard to mental health. I think that has fundamentally transformed the way we think about it and the way in which it is fully incorporated or needs to be fully incorporated in everything we think about when we think about public health. Now, Roy, in his introductory remarks, talked about the fact that much of the impetus for the development of the medical/health home came around our concerns with chronic illnesses. And you can see many of the chronic illnesses we've talked about today. Diabetes is one that's almost always featured, asthma, et cetera, et cetera. It turns out that mental health and substance use conditions are the most chronic illnesses. They occur, the average prevalence, the median age at which people who will have a lifetime diagnosis receive or could be diagnosed with a mental illness is age 14. On average, there's a 10-year hiatus between a person meeting criteria for diagnosis and them receiving any treatment, and that's moving through the ages of sort of on average 14 through 24, and that's when people can pick up cigarettes, they can start using alcohol, they can get involved in risky sexual behavior, all things that put them at increased lifetime risk for other morbidities and for disability. So it's key that we fully incorporate mental health when we think about the transformation that our healthcare system has been going through. We also have substantial information that informs us that mental health and substance use conditions are the most likely co-occurring condition with another chronic illness. So if you have diabetes or if you have cardiac disease, if you have arthritis, your most likely co-occurring illness is depression or anxiety disorder. Now, for people who have depression, anxiety disorder that's untreated, costs dramatically increase. The cost of care dramatically increase, typically by a multiplier or two to three times. So they're twice or three times as expensive to treat, and outcomes are significantly compromised. Probably the best study with regard to that is a study called IMPACT that looked at the treatment using a collaborative care model, very similar to a medical home model for older adults who had diabetes, all of whom had depression, half of whom received competent care, the other half received some basic supportive kind of information. In that study, people who had their depression, did not have their depression treated, and these are older adults, had mortality rates, two-year mortality rates that were twice as high as the people who had their depression effectively treated. We know the same story for cardiac disease, and untreated depression dramatically affects longevity and disability associated with cardiac disease. So we've got a strong evidentiary base to move forward with fully incorporating mental health into the medical home model. We also know that people with severe mental illnesses in this country who are served in state systems die on average 25 years early. So their mean life expectancy is in the 50s, 53. And they die from suicide at a rate 12 times higher than you would expect from a general population. Now I'm talking specifically about people who have schizophrenia. But they die from infectious diseases at four times the rate you would expect, cardiovascular diseases at two times the rate. So even if you think about persons who were traditionally segregated into a separate system of care where probably their primary mental health, or their primary health care needs were not well attended. There's a very strong rationale for including mental health services integrally in the medical home. However, owing in part, I think, to the historical kind of segregation of mental health services, owing to the kind of the development of that in our country over the last 200 years, this integration has not been well achieved. Even though we know that mental health and substance use conditions are the most likely co-occurring illness with other chronic illnesses, many protocols still do not call for screening for mental health and substance use conditions for persons who have been diagnosed with other kinds of chronic illnesses. And I think our challenge, and really part of the challenge of the medical home in general, is how does one go about integrating these services within a health care, medical care system that's highly fragmented and is characterized by a large number of solo or small group practices, right? So a lot of the things that we talked about today really talked about more multi-specialty oriented settings like the FQHCs as opposed to the, you know, the highly sort of the highly segregated and differentiated small group practices which characterize the country. And of course, this notion of building a medical home helps to address that in part through enhanced reimbursement for case management types of services. So there's sort of three things I think we should be thinking about when you think about mental health in the medical home. The first is prevention. You know, in 2009, the Institute of Medicine National Research Council released a comprehensive report on what we know about our ability to effectively prevent mental, emotional, behavioral disorders. And it's very clear from the data presented in that report that we have scientifically sound, rigorous information to lead us to believe that there is a whole range of interventions, many of which can be implemented in primary care settings that dramatically reduce the rates at which people will become ill. The best known study to me is the Seattle Social Development Project, in which on 15-year follow-up, persons who received the preventative intervention were 38% less likely to have a mental health diagnosis than persons who were served in the control conditions. There's a dramatic difference 15 years following the termination of that intervention, number one. Number two, it's clear that children and adolescents who were served in pediatric practices generally, and certainly in practices that characterize themselves as the medical home, should receive a mental health checkup. We need to work to reduce this 10-year gap between a person meeting diagnostic criteria and their actually receipt of services. The good news is we have reliable and valid, easily administered screening devices for kids, and we know a lot about how we have to organize case management services following the identification of conditions so that they get the care that they need. Of course, within a fully integrated medical home in which a behaviorist, who could be a nurse, by the way, is included in that home, we'll see that those services will be much more easily provided and directly integrated care, which is, of course, a great home. And then finally, for the management of chronic illnesses in general, we're fortunate, again, to have a very considerable scientific base about what's called the collaborative care model. And that's a model in which behaviorists of one sort or another, they could be bachelor's-level case managers with professional experience or nurses or psychologists, depending upon reimbursement available and the organization of the care environment. We now have 34 randomized trials that shows that those types of interventions are very successful in terms of the treatment of depression, anxiety disorders, with five-year outcomes showing dramatically reduced rates of depression for persons who were served in those kind of clinics. The barriers we face is time, basically. just tell me that our time is up. We need to think about organizational variables. Again, this notion of how do you organize a system that's largely a group of small businesses, and financial barriers. And I think some of the things we talked about today in terms of insurance company mandatory participation can help with funding these services as they have in Pennsylvania and in Vermont as well. So Roy, thank you.
Right. Thank you. And the object lesson here is we don't all need to rely on PowerPoint. Now the floor is yours. Please make your comments. As far as I know, we don't have a microphone. Is there anybody in the House that happens to have a microphone in their hand? Okay, so we don't have a microphone, so please stand up, identify yourself by name and organizational affiliation only, and make your comments. If you want to address any presenters specifically, you can do that as well. Yeah.
Hi, Phil Greiner from Facing University. Could you, as a group, address the role of community health centers in the role of developing the medical home? Because I think it addresses what you mentioned as far as integrating services. A number of you, and I know you can address it, as far as being first managed, and also for some of the rest of you, how that intersects with what you may be doing in your areas.
Right. Well, I think the community health center model in so many ways really is a medical home model. I mean, it was before the medical home became the thing to talk about. And I think that, it can really be a proving ground to show that when you do this, and when you look at the outcomes for community health centers, you already see it. You can show that when you have all of these services on site and they're so comprehensive, and you have farmers markets and literacy initiatives and all these different things going on that are so comprehensive, it really does improve outcomes for patients. And in our situation, for the National Nursing Center's consortium standpoint, a number of our members, not a majority yet, but many of them are community health centers too, so they are nurse-led community health centers, FQHCs. And I think that, you really see this great overlap with the nursing model of care, which is very focused on prevention and sort of management of chronic diseases and not just diagnosis of illness and treatment of illness once it develops. I think that you really see, this great overlap between the community health center model and also the nursing model, and you can achieve these really outstanding results when you combine those two things.
Yeah, and when you combine them, I think you come up with the healthcare home model, really. The so-called medical home really comes closer to that FQHC and nursing perspective, and that's actually why the healthcare home term came out of the community health centers, and that is the one that we have collectively agreed within APHA that comes closest to capturing the applicability of the model to public health. Yeah.
Hi, I'm Ariel Sarmiento from Montefiore Medical Center and Children's Health Fund in New York City. I'd like to hear if ever you've gone through this. Any of the panelists, if you have gone through the application for the patient-centered medical home model for the NCQA accreditation, if anybody has gone through the application process, we can share a little bit.
You're trying to find a survival rate? You guys did.
Yeah, we did, related to the Pennsylvania Chronic Care Initiative, the increased reimbursement that was available for the practices was based on certification by NCQA, and so while the objectives that we were trying to meet, the goals we were trying to reach, were measures for asthma for pediatric practices or diabetes for the adult practices, the increased reimbursement was based on certification by NCQA. And in our area, which was Southeast Pennsylvania, there were about 35 practices that participated in the collaborative, and every one did get certified by NCQA at one of the levels. We applied and were very surprised that we made certification to level 3, which was the highest level of certification. When we counted up our points, we didn't think we had gone quite as high as they actually awarded points. Reaching the highest level of certification, I'd say, is very heavily tied to having an electronic medical record and good information technology, but it is possible to make the level 1 or level 2, possibly even level 3, without an EMR. And I currently am consulting with various other practices in the Philadelphia region about that are interested in going through that process, and so if you want to talk more about it, I'd be happy to talk about it afterwards.
Hi, Lon Berkeley. I work at the Joint Commission, which is the national board, accrediting body for when people know it from hospitals. We also do a lab, x-ray lab, mental health, home care, long-term care, and ambulatory care. Within the ambulatory care, we accredit over 300 community health centers and medical group practices. My background was running the state association in Illinois of all the FQHCs. so I bring you both of those worlds. And as a result of the number of community health centers that we're looking at, recognition, by the way, that's the term NCQA. By the way, people know NCQA stands for National Committee on Quality Assurance. NCQA's recognition program. The Joint Commission is building a product that will have medical home on top of accredited organizations. Unfortunately, we are adding another term to the mix. We're going to call it a primary care home. And then we want to make sure, don't forget, along with the medical home, home health care home, we're going to at least test the term primary care home. Medicare is using advanced primary care practice. Advanced primary care practice. So it's going to be at least four terms for a few years until things settle out. And obviously, the goal is for primary care to be the role of primary care is going to make sure that it doesn't need a patient-centered front of it or a medical home front. That's the way primary care will be delivered in this country in 10 years. But in any case, we got four terms now. Our primary care home is being built on top of an accredited organization. That's because, obviously, at the Joint Commission, we believe that quality goes beyond just the important stuff that's part of the medical home, which is access to care, coordination of care. But if you're accredited, you also deal with infection control, you deal with emergency management, you deal with credentialing and privileging, you deal with wave testing. So those organizations that are already accredited, we want to make sure that they'll be eligible for the additional reimbursement through the demonstration projects that exist for all of the opportunities that are out there. Our other model, though, is going to be different than NCQA's approach. In addition to, you have to be accredited, which is one survival rate and transformation that many organizations, including the community health system, have to go through. But it's also going to be an on-site evaluation. NCQA is an electronic submission of all of your information, as you well know. This is going to be included as part of the on-site visit that our surveyors make, so that it enables both identification of where there are gaps or non-compliant components, but it will hopefully enable us to do a better job of being broader relative to the mental health, the nutrition, the dentistry, the laboratory aspect of it by our approach of doing tracers for looking at compliance with everything that is set for infection control and credentialing and privileging. We'll also look at whether it's patient-centered in terms of the amount of patient education. Are they following up from a referral to a behavioralist, to a nutritionist, to an x-ray? So it's a different approach to the approach. So hoping that will just add to the our role as the Joint Commission, not to be different or competing with NCQA, because this is for those organizations that decide that accreditation is also valuable as part of the evolution toward or transformation toward their healthcare services.
Will there be any economic benefit to the Joint Commission accreditation?
The intent is, once our draft standards are out, we are going through our developmental process. We hope to have the draft out for public comment in the middle of December. There'll be at least a 6-week period for comment, so we have to, if anybody goes to our website, we'll have a place where you can check and click in order for us to let you know when these new standards are out. Once we have the draft out, we are going to be meeting with all of the Medicaid agencies for sure, and as many of the third-party payers that are available to make just determine whether or not our additional set of standards, and it's going to be, only for us, it's going to be somewhere between 20 and 25 additional standards above accreditation, to see whether or not they'll recognize that or accept that for the enhanced reimbursement. And in some states, we've got language already that says NCQA recognition or its equivalent. As a way of addressing that. So that's, if anybody here would like any further information about it, I'd be happy to do that. But I am interested, and by the way, the consortium team is very important in helping us with making sure that our definition of the primary care home is as broad as possible. But while you talked about the resolution, it's the first I've heard here for APHA. What exactly is the resolution? I was possibly get a copy of that.
Yeah, if you give me your card, I'll email you a PDF. If you're a member, you can go to APHA/policy, and then you'll be badgered for logons and passwords that you either don't have or forgot.
The main thing is just for APHA to endorse the
concept. It is to endorse the concept, yes. No, it's quite specific, and what the policy resolution, which drew on a lot of Mona in particular was very involved in drafting this, as were people from a lot of other sections. Essentially, what we tried to do was make the case that the healthcare home model, and I have to say that in developing the policy statement, I became aware of a level of dislike of the term medical that I wasn't quite prepared for. It's an issue and within public health community. But once we changed it to healthcare home and we reviewed all the applicable terms and thought that was best, it's been moving rather smoothly through process. And essentially, it makes the case that the goals, the overarching goals of APHA, which are public health goals, are that this model contributes to the meeting of those goals in terms of access, health disparities, healthcare costs, chronic disease management, you name it. This is the bridge from point of service delivery care to public health, and that's the gist of a whatever 30-page document. So there's a lot more there, but that's the essential piece of it. And it is, you know, no guarantee that it will be passed. The voting will be Tuesday, but it, you know, it's encouraging at this point. Yeah.
My name is Jen Jackman. I'm from the Grand County Rural Health Network here in Colorado, and it's a rural community here in Colorado. And one of the barriers we're facing in implementing the medical home initiative here is lack of resources, be it funding, staff time, human capital, whatever that looks like. And I'm wondering if you could address, anybody on the panel could address some of those ways that other rural communities in America might overcome some of those issues in order to become accredited for PCMH.
Yeah.
I don't know. The accreditation process, I don't know that there's any concessions made to the unique challenges in rural communities. I think that there are very specific issues of access in rural communities like transportation and adequacy of workforce that make it difficult to establish a practice that will meet those goals. For people that may not be, who may be wondering why the emphasis on reimbursement, this model of care is more time consuming. And if you really think, and I had the opportunity to have my mind shaped as a healthcare administrator for a while in a hospital, and it's talk about survival rate. It makes you think about healthcare in terms of how many billable visits, what's your reimbursement per billable, how many are uncompensated because of insurance or because of other kinds of issues. And so when you come up with a viable business plan where you have a high rate of uninsured, as is the case in rural communities, and you have a high rate of no-show because of transportation issues, you got a problem. And I think there are unique challenges there that are, you know, I wish I had a solution to them, but I think we're better at identifying the problems than the solutions. You want to say something on that?
Yeah, I think that, you know, the NCQA standards are focused on process and structure of practice. And there's a lot about primary care practice that can be improved in terms of the way it's structured and the processes of care. And so in that regard, those standards can really help to think through what's going on within the practice and whether it's only going to be a demand-centered operation, meaning, you know, whatever concerns people have when they come in the door are the main focus, or whether some of that focus may move to what is referred to by the chronic care community as planned care, planned visits, visits which are specifically structured to be able to address the chronic disease issues that the patient may have, or whether if you have other people on the team who may have, you know, significantly less training, but who are in the position to learn health coaching techniques or motivational interviewing or self-management goal setting, which are not highly highly skilled processes, that it can help you think about all of those and how you can add to your structure in a way that can accomplish more of the goals of primary care.
Okay.
Can I add something too? I think that what Mona said before about, I'm not a clinician, so I don't have firsthand experience going through the procedure, but I do think that electronic health records, based on what I've heard, are extremely integral to the process of transforming yourself into a medical home. And right now there are these EHR incentives, you know, to develop meaningful use and all that. And, you know, if you adopt or begin to adopt an electronic health record and you serve a high percentage of Medicaid beneficiaries, there's new money from the federal government that can help you do that. So that at least covers a little bit of the cost.
Yeah, in that regard, it's meaningful use, because if you meet those meaningful use standards, you can get that, you know, significant kind of subsidy to establish an EMR.
And I, if you give me your card afterwards, Vermont, I think, has done a really interesting job of implementing with state leadership primary care medical homes in very rural areas. And they, and part of the way they addressed the resources was by taxing each of the insurance companies. And the story we heard on Friday when I heard this presented was, although the insurance companies initially said that that was unfair, they didn't want to do it, once it actually happened, they actually were happy about it because it did help them solve some problems that they were having around coordination of care. It's a very limited leverage, actually, as a purchaser. So I can give you information about who to contact in Vermont, although I think these other answers are
actually. That's a very good solution. The money has to come somewhere. What in New York State, insurers were taxed 3% of capitation to support school-based health centers, and as you can imagine, that was initially unpopular, but it soon more than paid for itself in preventing emergency department visits, so that it's, you know, if that's a direction that you might be able to go in at the state level, the leverage piece would be, it costs you very little at the front end, and you save on reduced emergency department visits for individuals with chronic conditions on the other side. Yeah.
Actually, I want to just mention two more things. Kate Lorig, L-O-R-I-G, at Stanford, and Peer Self-Management Education. She has done a tremendous amount of work and showed efficacy and cost-benefit for peer self-management. And they have done also a great deal of work to make this culturally competent. And so if you go to their website, you may also find some other resources to get things going in your community.
Stanford Chronic Disease,
and it's Kate Lorig, L-O-R-I-G.
Okay, yes, sir.
Bernie Barbato with Fort Collins Family Medicine Residency Program, the Health District of Northern Larimer County. This is more of a comment than anything else. I think that the key message that I keep hearing in PCMH talk is the co-location of services. And I think that community health centers and residency programs tend to be perfectly designed for that. The question ends up becoming, how do we co-locate services in the real primary care world? Because my residents leave residency and they say, gosh, I have a social worker and a substance abuse counselor and a behaviorist and a case manager, but when I go out in the real world, I don't have that. And one of the things that I'm thinking about as I'm hearing these conversations is, how do we move from a wasteful separation of services? I think the classic thing in our community is the Larimer Center for Mental Health is separate from all of the primary care institutes, but it's where most of folks frankly get their care because they can't serve, they can't afford mental health services. How do we begin to push people to co-locate services? And I don't really see that as part of NCQA. What I see as part of NCQA is the being able to document what you do. So you refer someone to mental health and you see if they follow up. Well, my patients can't follow up, frankly, because there's no transportation. In fact, there's like a few bus routes in Fort Collins, and there are, if you live in LaPorte or slightly outside of them, you can't go. It's just not possible. And so I think that that's actually what we found to be the most successful piece of what our PCMH is the fact that when I have someone who needs a behavioral health screening, I ask the behavioral health person to come up and do it, because I don't have time to do it. You know, when I need someone to get CBT, I call my director of behavioral health and say, which one of your interns could do CBT with this patient tomorrow? And then everything's done there. The challenge comes in is that in our county, Medicaid must be served by LCMH, or by the local mental health organization. And because of that, that means that Medicaid patient has to go to LCMH. And as a patient, they're going to choose to go to one place or the other. And so one of the things I'm looking for, as APHA advocates for this stuff a little bit, is really the clear advocacy for the co-location. And I think that that's absolutely an essential part.
already. I just want to make one comment, then I know David wants to speak to this. Co-location is extremely important on the level of access, but experience has shown that co-location alone doesn't guarantee integration of services. And so from the standpoint, I think, of meeting the criteria for a healthcare home, integrated services trumps co-location. And I just want to make that point because I think sometimes people think co-location equals integrated services and people's doors can be across a narrow corridor and they still don't know what the other one is doing. David?
Yeah, and to kind of to sort of further punctuate that remark, that Cherokee Health Systems in Tennessee is one of the systems that's typically touted as being very successful. And they do have co-location. But when you hear them talk about the integration of behavioral health benefits, they said that part of it is really getting behaviorists to work in a primary care setting and adopt a primary care culture, which I think sort of speaks to what Ray's talking about, Roy's talking about as well, in that it's a different culture in a primary care environment than it is in a 60-minute therapy session, et cetera, et cetera. Number one. Number two, that around the FQHCs, the community mental health centers now, and Larimer County is one of these, are going to be able to become something like a primary care medical home through the Affordable Care Act. So they have now a mechanism that has been created to start to incorporate primary care into the CMHCs. It'll be interesting to see what sort of the cultural adaptation that occurs there. So I think that's a progress as well.
Okay, 3-minute warning. So,
My name is Alexandra Locke. I'm actually doing a fellowship at a community health center in Massachusetts that just got an award to integrate the patient-centered medical home. And I really think that your point is important. And I'm kind of wondering, I think that community health workers could be a really important attribute to the patient-centered medical home. And when I've been looking at the legislation and how we are currently implementing this medical home, we are tending to stick with nurses and we haven't integrated community health workers yet. And I think that could be a really, to tie social services together, because transportation is a huge issue. And the issue with our patients is that we can't get them to come because they don't have housing, they don't have insurance, and I'm wondering if you guys could comment on how we could integrate community health workers into this model.
I think that there are people that are working on the idea of certification for community health workers, and that would go a long way towards legitimizing the profession and making it reimbursable. I think that one of the problems that we have with really sustaining a team approach is not only at the primary care side, reimbursing for the commensurate to the visit time, but then there are issues of reimbursing people like Cindy here, where registered dietitians may or may not, depending upon the patient's medical condition or lack thereof, that is whether or not they have diabetes or hypertension or whatever. If you want to prevent that, they don't, by definition, have it, and that may not be reimbursable. So there's a lot that has to happen at the, I think we're pretty much talking about Medicaid populations. There's a lot that has to happen with regard to Medicaid reimbursement. And another piece, because we talk about co-location, but sometimes the downside of co-location on the financial end is that you can't bill for multiple visits at the same visit date in the same site. And that's part of the reason that we have such a fractured healthcare system, is that is financially sustainable, and integration of care is much more challenging to sustain financially. I think we have time for one more comment.
Wait, can I respond to that also?
Yeah.
Some of the reimbursement systems are providing incentives to practices that meet certain quality metrics, and depending upon how many dollars are at stake for those incentives, it can provide a significant infusion of additional resources into the practice, and then practices will be deciding how to spend those dollars. And so I think they'll spend them in a variety of different ways. And so I would say, if you're interested in community health workers, one of the most important things you could do is to gather together the evidence on the benefit of community health workers, and then go to places where, physicians are discussing this and deciding how to spend their resources and present that case to them. There's a lot of work going on right now to show that navigators are useful. And so I think, you know, that data on navigators is being presented, and community health workers in many places have been very successful. So if you want to help that agenda along, that would be a really important thing to do.
Okay, we are officially out of time, but if there's one final comment that somebody is burning to make, please feel free. Yes, sir.
Can you say something about private insurance reimbursement and public sector insurance reimbursement?
The enhanced reimbursement for certified, and I'm going to say medical home because that's what, the way the certification reads, it's discretionary. States have to decide whether or not they are going to honor that and what percentage increase would be associated with level one, level two, level three status. And the same is true for commercial insurers. From the standpoint of making your case, I think that reducing the best evidence that we have over the longest period of time has to do with the prevention or reduction of emergency department visits for people with very costly chronic conditions. The adult conditions tend to be diabetes and congestive heart failure. In pediatrics, it's almost all about asthma. There's some very compelling statewide data from North Carolina that saved millions and millions of dollars by implementing organizing its pediatric Medicaid population around a medical home model for asthma. I think that you make your case, but particularly with the commercial insurers, they're private entities and they can't be required to modify their reimbursement structure. That would be overregulation, I think, at the state level. And obviously the states have to decide how they want to handle their own Medicaid reimbursement, keeping in mind that that's what's driving the state budget deficits, typically, is Medicaid expenditures. Thank you to all of you. Fantastic amount of information, tightly packed, and thank you all for coming.